From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm John Gatto. We round out this edition of Newsmakers with a first-person account of the impact of climate change. Will Steger's accomplishments as a polar explorer are impressive. More than 25 years ago, he led the first unsupported group to the North Pole by dog sled and followed that trip with other firsts across Greenland and the South Pole. But as you're about to find out, conditions at the North Pole today are much different than they were when he made that first trip in 1986. And it's that change that has inspired Steger to educate people about the issue of climate change. He brought his message to the UW La Crosse campus this past winter, and while here he took time to talk with local media, including Wisconsin Public Radio's Maureen McCollum, about his views on climate change and his accomplishments as an explorer.
Well, I've been traveling the Arctic, the far north Arctic, both polar regions, Greenland, and I've been doing expeditions all my life, but why you do it is just the great adventure and the spirit of the north. And but I also like touring in these places that very few people have seen. So I travel mostly by dog team. And I've traveled probably a little over 50,000 miles by dog team in the north.
Can you talk about that first time when you decided, I'm assuming it's pack of dogs together, and we're gonna head up north?
I'm from the city, and my first trip was actually when I was 15. I took a motorboat down the Mississippi River from Minneapolis to New Orleans and back. And then I did a lot of climbing and kayaking expeditions all through my school years. But then when I was 25, I moved to Ely, Minnesota, to the wilderness. I had bought land in a wilderness area 3 miles from the nearest road. And so I moved there. In order to make a living, I started a dog sledding and skiing school. And the dogs served a dual purpose of making an income, but also it enabled me to bring supplies into my remote area. And this was like 1970. And in the late 70s, I had my school was up and running pretty well, and I had a pretty good dog team by then. And that's when I decided to start branching north by dogs, since I was familiar with the country on water and the rivers. And I knew also if I could master winter travel, especially with dogs, there were some areas that had never been seen before by human beings and a couple other geographical firsts. So I knew that if I could learn more, I could probably, travel into those areas.
Because it seems like if you can conquer Arctic exploration, you could probably almost conquer anything.
Yeah, the human mind is that way. If you have an interest and if it's really you and you have the freedom to explore where that interest. In my case, I was given freedom by my parents. And I was interested in the North Country, which probably has something to do with my Minnesota roots. You learn that you can adapt or master almost anything. But you first have to have that heart or that spirit to do it, because then once you focus your attention on it, you can pretty well accomplish anything. And the cold areas are too, for an outsider, it seems pretty harsh in that. But we're dressed and well and we know what we're doing, and I do a lot of research. I understand the weather and navigation and all this quite well. So what appears to be an edge, it turns out to be a really wide, wide surface once you get a little more familiar with what you're doing.
And you've been involved in expedition teams that have been the first in many fields. You were the first to go to the North Pole without a resupplying team, and I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
Yeah.
And maybe some of your other firsts as an explorer.
Yeah, in 1986, we were the first to confirmed unsupported expedition to the pole. In other words, we left northern Canada with 50 dogs, five dog teams, and 8 people, and we made all the full distance to the pole without outside support. Which would first of all include resupply or supplies, but we also navigated by sextant only. We didn't use any type of outside aid. The GPS was not around at that time, but there was still some primitive satellite navigational systems that we probably could have used. But we did that. We were the first to cross Antarctica unmechanized, and we did the long route, 3,700 miles. We'd crossed Greenland, the longest possible route, 1,600, unsupported, and a number of other expeditions that I've done, but those are just three of the bigger ones that I did.
And can you just talk about that feeling of accomplishment? I mean, to do something that well, you and your team that nobody else has done before.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, my teens and early 20s, being first on a mountain, the first ascent, that was kind of important to me at that time. But after a while, I just liked traveling for the traveling's sake. But the first exploring something where no one's been, there is a certain spirit to that that's really fascinating and very, very motivating. But it's really in my life to do these long expeditions where most people or almost all people say it's impossible to do. And you're traveling basically just on your faith and in your skills. And in the long run, having accomplished that is quite a remarkable thing, because most people travel on faith, and then a lot of times you don't see the outcome of what your faith is about, and I have through these expeditions. But it's a statement of, to a large degree, adaptation, teamwork, spirit, using your qualities as a human of intelligence and particularly intuition, because we, in our modern-day life, you know, we're really good at thinking and using our intellect, but most of us have lost track of our intuition, that guiding force that always tells you the right thing at the right time, a spontaneous force that does not allow on a, you know, doesn't as slow as an intellect. So combination of the intellect and the intuition is something that you apply a lot. And that is basically how Native people lived. You know, they didn't live so much top-heavy with mind. They did, they were really brilliant people and they could adapt, but they also had this intuitive power that guided them in most cases.
So when you head out on these expeditions, are they mostly in the spirit of wanderlust, or are there some research components to the trips?
Well, you know, I did long expeditions, and I think I would have quit over 20 years ago, but with the advent of the Internet enabled me to share these journeys and also to bring our adventures and our educational programs into the classroom. My real vocation is education. I have a master's in education, and I taught in the classroom for 3 years, and I've been involved in online, pioneering actually online education for 25 years. So the online component really gave us a really great purpose of being out there. We do a little bit of science, but we're more educational, because you can bring students and audience into areas, especially areas that are sometimes threatened. And also through the Internet, you can show interrelationships between how we are changing the Arctic and the effect the Arctic has on us.
And I'm wondering if you can talk about that. Over the decades that you've been exploring these polar regions, what are some of the biggest, most obvious, and maybe some of the less obvious changes that you've seen?
That's a very good question. I've studied weather all my life, and I actually taught global warming in my classes in the late 60s. And so I've always been up on the science of climate change. And the scientists predicted that in the 90s that the first changes would be in the polar regions. And since these areas are so unpeopled and remote, very few people have seen the changes. But I've kind of the eyewitness of all the polar regions that I've traveled on. The changes are quite a massive, but the ice shelves that I've traveled on, all the ice shelves in Antarctica and the Arctic have disappeared. It's actually impossible to reach the North Pole now by dog team because of the open water. I mean, the routes are so permanently varied, you know, different. The Greenland ice cap is just amazing in the summer, how much water is flowing out and how fast the glaciers are going. And this was according to what was predicted. And what was also predicted about 10 years ago is that in this latitude that we're in here in Minnesota, Wisconsin, we'd start seeing extreme weather events, which are really playing out. In fact, it's pretty hard to deny what's going on if you look around the world, the droughts and so forth. It isn't just one climate change. There's many events that are going around. So it's pretty alarming, and this is something that's going to affect our population, especially your generation that's young, and your children are the ones that are really going to be affected by this. Why we really need to pay attention to what's going on.
How healthy is the Earth, and what can we do to help the Earth?
Well, you know, we've really screwed up. The climate is changing now pretty rapidly. What's happening is the ice is starting to melt, and that has other repercussions, because like the Arctic Ocean 50%, that used to be totally frozen, or 95% frozen in the summertime, and that would reflect the light. We have 24-hour light for 5 months, a lot of energy. 50% of that ocean now is open during the summer, and that in other words, it's a darker surface, which is absorbing. So right now, as of just in the last couple of years, we're absorbing more heat than we're giving off on the Earth. So that's the tipping point right now. It's very serious. Methane is already starting to come out of the ground in the Arctic and the North Polar regions.
That's something you touched on that is different for that area.
Yeah, I mean, methane is, methane gas is 21 times more dangerous than CO2 and as a global warming gas, but that's being triggered by the warming climate in the oceans. And we've had somewhat control on the climate because we're emitting the CO2 by the burning of fossil fuels, but now with the methane that's starting, which is very serious, if that cycle continues, we're going to lose control of the weather cycles. So we're really on an edge. And what's more alarming than that is the fact that 50% of our population is denying this, including almost lockstep, a whole political party is denying the science to this. And this is totally irresponsible for your generation to, when the science is totally in. There is no debate whatsoever in the climate. In the climatology, they make believe as if there's some science debate. Within science, there's no debate. 97% of all scientists are on board on this. There's a 2% that are questioning various parts of the models, and there's 1% that are basically paid advocates from the fossil fuel industry that's casting this doubt in to cloak themselves in phony science.
And you're listening to Newsmakers. My guest today is Will Steger. He's a polar explorer. Our next question comes from Pat Anderson of the La Crosse Tribune.
What philosophies drove you to explore the Arctic, and how have those changed after what you've seen?
Yeah, I really didn't. I was inspired by Huck Finn, my first book that I read in third grade, The Adventures, and that's what got me down the river. And as a child, I was no different than the rest of my peers. We all liked adventure. I just made a living out of it. But I have this love of the North that I don't know if it's innate or something that, you know, I grew with. But I think a lot of people do share that same love. I mean, where I live in the Boundary Waters in the Quetico, the Canada area, many people go up there on canoe trips, I think, and understand that spirit. But it's not, I can't say it's really a philosophy. All my life I've been concerned for the planet and the innocence, God's creations and innocence. And so I've always had a natural concern for the environment and protecting that environment. But underlying, I've always had this vocation to educate people and bringing people together around these issues, because it's something that really affects us all.
But there must have been a moment where, you know, that first trip, that's a hard thing to mentally prepare for in the first place. What drove you to want to do that? You know, make that step.
Actually, what really I would have to say what's inspired me was the National Geographic magazine. Because when I was young, you didn't have access to three channels on TV that were, you know, all pretty boring. But then you had the yellow magazine with pictures in it and adventure. And that's what I kind of wrapped my dreams around, those pictures. And actually, when I was 13, I played hockey in Minneapolis as a kid. And I traded my hockey skates in for a sled load of National Geographics, and that's where I really made a change. You know, I decided that I wanted to do a life of adventure. So my first northern trip was when I was 17. I kayaked up the Inside Passage of Alaska, up the ocean, and crossed the mountains and went down headwaters of the Yukon, then down the Yukon. And at first I was really afraid of the north on that trip, but it really hooked me. The next year I kayaked 3,000 miles from the southern Canadian Rockies to the Arctic Ocean. And it was on those early trips, especially when I was 19, that was a coming-of-age trip. I traveled with a friend of mine that I used to wrestle with in high school, and it affected him too. He moved out of the city to northwestern Minnesota, and I moved to northeastern Minnesota. And that's where the spirit really hit me. I bought wilderness property in the home that I live on, that property, when I was 19. And I always had a really good, clear vision. I really have to thank my parents, though, for where I'm at and everything that I did, because I'm from a family of nine kids, and my dad was fought in World War II and came back and started his own company, and he was an entrepreneur. And he gave us a lot of freedom as kids. I basically, in high school, had very few rules. You know, I had to have a great point average, stay out of trouble with the law. I could do anything I wanted to as long as I paid for it. And I was motivated. First of all, I wanted my freedom, so I studied hard. But I wanted to travel, and especially in the north and off roads. And I just followed that spirit of adventure and the spirit of the entrepreneurial, the American dream, I think, that we all have a piece of. And I'm a product of that. But unknowingly, I became a spokesperson for the climate and the polar regions and the preservation of those areas. Never in my wildest dreams would I think that I'd be canoeing instead of dog sledding on the Arctic Ocean. I mean, this is like, what I've seen is totally astounding. And what we're starting to now see on the lower latitudes is also astounding, the changes that are coming our way.
As a polar explorer, then, do you feel that people maybe take you more seriously since you've been there and you've experienced the region yeah. versus maybe a scientist crunching numbers?
Yeah. That's a very good question, because obviously people are very confused by the science, because we have the fossil fuel industry pumping in over $100 million a year, and this is all on the Internet, into disinformation and doubt. They're doing the same campaign that they did in the 50s and 60s with tobacco, which cost a lot of lives, including my father. So the public is confused, and I understand their confusion, and I know where the confusion is coming from. So science, it goes over a lot of people's heads, but the real eyewitness account of the photography and the presence that I can give to that is more common sense. People catch on. That, along with presenting the science in an appropriate way, people catch on what's going on. It's amazing the impact I've had on tens and tens of thousands of people. And in Minnesota, we've been able to actually move our state into more renewables and so forth through this effort of eyewitness account. So the eyewitness account, I think, is extremely valuable, because it gives you almost another format to focus the picture on. And then if you apply the science to show the science and how the science works and why the melting ice and so forth, it makes a lot of sense to people. I purposely talk as much as I speak, as much as I can, to conservative audiences. I don't shy away from the controversy at all. I mean, I can talk to the choir and the people that understand this, and that's great too. But my main focus is really with the conservative areas, the people that really are, I think, have the wrong information, and I find most conservatives catch on right away if it's just applied right. Because in a way, the wool has been pulled over a lot of people's eyes by fossil fuel campaign, and that's very easy if you just sit down and spend an hour with people to see through that and see the directions now that we have to go. I wouldn't be sitting here if the solutions weren't economic. This is all about recapturing a $3 trillion fossil fuel industry that they do not want to let go of this market. But we're looking at 50% of this creating new clean energies, wind, solar, biomass, and geothermal, and so forth. And then energy efficiency, the conservation, is a big one. That's the other 50%, and that's where all the jobs are going to be. And I would say, if we get it together as a country here, that at least 30% of your generation, the younger generation that's in school now, are going to have jobs in these new industries. Because the fossil fuel industry, in comparison to what we will be employing in the cleaner energy industry, is a tremendous number of jobs there. So it's really a win-win for everybody, especially for young people. But the fossil fuel industry is not willing to let go of their market. They want to get as much energy out of the ground and sell it as quickly as possible. And they have the clout and the money behind that to get by with what they're doing. They buy, you know, you can look at where the money, trace the money. They buy scientists, they buy a president, they buy a political party. You know, it's a strong power. But, you know, I don't get angry about it. Let's just get educated and get organized and get this thing moving. You know, get it really a positive for us in bringing people together. The problem right now is we're split as a country. Everybody's tired of this split. But I believe that energy is something that's going to draw us right, left, and middle together, because it's American jobs. It's not jobs from Saudi Arabia or wherever our oil is coming from. It's Wisconsin jobs. It's Minnesota jobs. We're looking at a good tax base, better schools. We're cutting everything right now because we don't have a tax base. Well, imagine if I can speak to Minnesota. Minnesota spends $15 billion a year in fossil fuels. We don't have a drop of oil or a lump of coal. That money goes outside of the state. We want to capture that, you know, 80% of that $15 billion, which will grow more and more in the next 25 years, and that's an incredible industry.
One thing that it seems like anytime there's weather out of the ordinary, people are quick to jump to the fact that it's climate change. Like, for instance, this winter, we've had a warmer winter than we've had in a long time. Yeah. I mean, can that be blamed on climate change?
No, you have to be careful because both sides can use that. Well, it's warmed, and the last year we had the snow, and then where's your climate change? That is basically weather from the day to day. Climate is the overall average, and so what we have to look at in climate is basically a world view of it, and the statistics. And the statistics of extreme weather events is basically going straight up, along with insurance costs for weather events. Insurance pretty much mirrors the weather events. Insurance is going way up for weather right now, and there's a lot of areas that you cannot get insurance anymore with weather-related events. So you have to look at the overall. No, you can't say a warm winter is climate change or a snowfall is no climate change. But we have to look at the overall extremes, and the extremes are actually quite obvious of what's happening.
Famed polar explorer Will Steger. Today he lives in Ely, Minnesota, where he operates the Will Steger Foundation, committed to exploration and education. He visited UW La Crosse this past winter, where he spoke about the issue of climate change. He also answered questions in our studios from local media, including WPR's Maureen McCollum and Pat Anderson of the La Crosse Tribune. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Our production team includes Maureen McCollum, Steve Rysom, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers or have suggestions for future programs, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more online at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, follow us at WPR Newsmakers. That's on Facebook.